I am encouraged that we have some phenomenal colleagues helping us right now. And you probably know that Jeff Banks, the former acting director of OMB, has now been tapped by the Secretary and President to oversee the website issues. And they have made a commitment to fix these by the end of November, over the next number of weeks, actually. So I'm hoping that in a very short period of time, we can now report back to you and others that we can welcome everybody into this process. Again, try to keep it as simple as easy for possible. I think your suggestion is one that we welcome, but I think these colleagues that have moved to going through this so-called country, getting us to a new project that in just several weeks will be more of a project. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Coe. Thank you for that question. I think we all are anxious for this to be implemented so that we can do the wonderful things this act allows for us to do. And now I think we're in good shape for Dr. Sam.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Sorry for the delay. I did upload it in accordance to the rules last night, but there you go, it didn't work. My name is Fiona Sim. Thank you very much for the introduction. Since the 1st of April this year, a lot of that CV in terms of current roles has changed, as I'll be describing here, because the system in the UK has changed fairly dramatically. We've been watching with great interest what's happening with the US system, and great excitement at the prospect of the US moving steadily towards universal health coverage. So we wish you all that is well in that direction. And it's a great privilege to be able to talk a little bit comparatively with colleagues here today in the US. And I've just been reminded when I arrived here today, I'm an alumna of the Public Health Leadership Institute here, year six, if anybody else is still here from year six. I remember that well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the changes that we've undergone, or we're still really in transition in England particularly, with a little bit of international flavour, I hope. So, the reforms in the UK actually were English, or are English reforms that came into being this April. We've made a habit of reforming the health service since it was introduced in 1948, so I'll mention a little bit about that strange habit we have of reforming our system. The risks associated with reform, which some of which I think are relevant to yourselves here, and perhaps something a little bit about predicting the impact of the reforms on the health of the population. So very briefly, because I know people have got more interesting things to talk about, but history doesn't hurt to at least give some thought to. So the NHS, National Health Service in the UK, came into being in July 1948. These are just the major reorganisations since then, so I'm not going to go through them. But you can see there have been an awful lot of them. And with or without explanation, we've lived through many reorganisations. So why reform again in 2013? You may know the great British public elected a government in 2010. In fact, we didn't elect a coalition government, but that's what we have. And the coalition government stated that modernisation of the health service is needed because of these reasons: their rising demand and cost. Our cancer survival rates were poor relative to many other countries, particularly in Europe. And finances, again, were problematic. And the legislative changes were going to draw on 20 years' worth of reform, which was fascinating, really, because the reforms, by and large, in the UK have not been evaluated. So drawing on the lessons from those reforms was quite an interesting challenge for government. However, there we are. So what might we expect from reform? So this is really from a point of view of people who've got the interest of the health of our population at heart. What might we expect from reform? Clearly better healthcare, better outcomes, improved population health, a more efficient system, better value for money, reduced health inequalities, better satisfaction for patients, and I think it's important to say something about the morale of the people working in the system. In the UK, the NHS is the biggest employer by some way, and the people working in that service, therefore, are a major proportion of the population. I mean, most of us heard Michael Marmot speaking yesterday, so we're all aware that health inequalities exist within countries as well as between countries. And over many years of coming to APHA and talking about health inequalities, health disparities in the UK, people often have a difficulty reconciling very major, extensive health inequalities and persisting health inequalities, despite the fact that we've had 65 years' worth of universal health care. And very obviously, to most of us in public health, there isn't a simple answer in terms of health care provision to health inequalities. And health inequalities are unfortunately alive and sadly well, and being addressed, but not as effectively as most of us would like, across a whole system, not just in healthcare provision. So they're a really big issue still in the UK, despite universal healthcare. So I'd say that really is as a health warning, that coverage is a contributor to reducing inequalities, but only a relatively modest contributor. What did the government want out of the reforms? The outcomes framework for the National Health Service is published and republished annually, and it says the sort of things that you would expect of a government to expect of its healthcare system. I'm not going to read those out, but they're fairly standard expectations and virtuous expectations of a system. Whether changing the system will make a difference to those outcomes is what we're looking at now. Just to give you a little bit of context, the UK isn't doing all that well, but as Michael pointed out yesterday, the UK does better than the US in terms of health outcomes and life expectancy. So that's where we are, or we have been very recently, 2010, and those figures haven't changed a great deal in the last few years. And similarly, the US is way out front in terms of expenditure on healthcare, but as you saw before, not in terms of outcomes. The UK is sort of middle of the road. We've actually gone up. We're up nudging 10% GDP spend on health now. And we've seen real growth up until quite recently, certainly within the tenure of the Labour government. Up until 2010, there was a steady increase in expenditure on health, some improvement in outcomes, but not a clear, fantastically good correlation. There's the spend on health in the UK, which you can see has been steadily increasing. This I thought was interesting, and I don't know whether similar studies have been done in the US, but by and large, the public isn't keen in recent times to see its taxes increase in order for healthcare spend to increase. So the degree of altruism that one might anticipate or aspire to in terms of increasing taxation spend to improve health may or may not be quite where one would like it to be. Okay. I want to say a little bit about austerity, which clearly every country of the world, I think, is now facing. So what is the impact of austerity on funding, first of all? Having seen increases in spend on health, that is grinding to a halt. Although we're seeing a slowdown, we're not seeing a total cessation of increased spend, but nothing like what we've seen in the past decade. However, at a time of austerity, we do expect to see increases in need for healthcare. And we know that ill health, these are the basics of what everybody who practices in public health is clearly aware of already. But ill health, we know, is associated with unemployment, poverty, social inequalities, conditions, both physical and mental, and social unrest. And we mustn't forget, I don't think, that social unrest will have a great impact on need and demand for healthcare provision. So austerity doesn't only affect funding and need, it also affects delivery. And there is concern that we're seeing already service cuts in the UK, certainly in England. We're being required to improve productivity at the same time as reducing funding and therefore increasing efficiency. We're seeing impacts on staff morale, or we would expect to see that impact. Stress in the whole system and a risk to maintaining quality. So I put up a slide about health impact assessment simply because in an ideal world, or even in an ordinary, normal world, one might expect that the anticipated health impact of a massive intervention like reforming the health system would be subject to a health impact assessment in order to find out before its implementation what the likely effect was going to be. And typically we've had health impact assessments about the Olympic Games, about the Commonwealth Games, about numerous transport policy developments. But it's not usually applied to health policy. If anybody knows why that is the case, I'd be really interested to know. But certainly in the UK, health impact assessment is not routinely applied to health policy interventions. So had it been applied to the reforms, this is purely hypothetically because they all came into being on the 1st of April this year in England, how might the reforms benefit health, we would want to know. How might they harm health? Equally importantly, we would want to know, perhaps more importantly. So assessing the health impact clearly was a question that many of us wished to ask, and in many ways it's an opportunity foregone. We're now looking at evaluating to find out what the impact will have been, but we haven't done the predictive health impact assessment. So what are the reforms? Very briefly, because most of you, I'm sure, are much more interested in terms of the nitty-gritty of the reform in the US than in the UK. But the Health and Social Care Act was finally passed after a lot of debate in 2012 and implemented from the 1st of April this year. The reforms apply to England only. They are massively far-reaching reforms to the NHS as a whole and to the public health delivery system. The government felt it was necessary to explain the reforms, quite rightly, and it took them 19 fact sheets to be able to do so. They are very complex. A lot of us wondered why 19, but because it doesn't sound such a big number as 20, so a number of the fact sheets actually include lots of different areas packed into a smaller number. So 19, I think, is a pretty big number of fact sheets to try and explain the reforms. The chief executive of the NHS in England described the reforms as so big that you could see them from space. He said that with a good deal of pride. So they're extensive and complex. They affect structure, function, and funding of the system. So very briefly, commissioning of healthcare is largely now in the hands of clinical commissioning groups, which are clinically led, and the clinical leadership comes from primary care, so from family physicians, very largely. I have to declare an interest, or perhaps I don't have to, but I will, I now find myself on the board of a clinical commissioning group. It's one of those things, the decision you make is to go into the tent rather than not. And it's a fascinating place to be. A lot of enthusiasm, very little experience of commissioning. Public health, in turn, has largely moved into local government. Public health has joined the National Health Service in the UK in 1974. With a good deal of enthusiasm from those leaders of public health at the time who saw great opportunities to be aligned with the rest of the healthcare system rather than outside it in local government. The jury is now out. Much of public health now is within local government again. Many would say it's its natural home, working with alongside those services which are closely related to the determinants of health rather than with health care. For me as a public health physician working within the NHS, the loss of public health expertise capacity in commissioning health care is quite significant. So again, it will be interesting to see how this change pans out. Regulation has been increased, and I won't go into the detail of that. The opportunity for providers from sectors outside the public sector has been expanded. So from being very much a socially provided service, we're now a socially funded service with providers, any qualified provider, so any provider which wishes and meets the criteria for providing services can now enter the marketplace. And increasingly we're seeing private companies seeing opportunities to become providers to the National Health Service. Patient voice, a new organisation called Health Watch has been introduced. It's too early to start to be either cynical or optimistic, I think, in terms of its clout, its voice. The mantra is no decision about me without me. And again, we do mantras quite well in the NHS, but it is too early to know what the impact will be. But patient voice clearly is a relevant feature of the new reforms and an important feature of any healthcare system. We've got a plethora of new organisations beginning to bed in, beginning to find their roles, and still quite a lot of confusion about who has responsibility for precisely what in the new system. And that brings its own risks, which I'll go on to. At the same time as all the reforms, we've got the demands of austerity, so improving efficiency as well as quality and productivity in a finite resource environment. So David Nicholson is the chief exec of the NHS that I mentioned earlier until March next year when he stands down. And his challenge to the whole system is to save £20 billion by 2015. So it'll be interesting to see if the challenge outlives his tenure. The other context is that local government funds social care, funds many other services which are relevant to health, particularly population health, and they're seeing probably in real terms more real reductions in funding than the health system. So in terms of the context of actually improving the health of the population, real risks there. Some pictures, slightly cheating here, because I think I'm not sure that the NHS last year was really as simple as it's shown on here, but I'm grateful to the Nuffield Trust for some of its pretty pictures, which does simplify the system. This is post-reform, just to show you the regulatory system. Some of my colleagues in Oxford produced an even more exciting picture of post-reforms, and then we tried to produce one just about the public health system. So I'm not in not in any way going to stop at these, but just to demonstrate the complexity of the system and the fact that we are still struggling to know exactly where the responsibilities lie in many areas, including public health and health protection. So the strengths of the reforms, potentially the clinically led and clinical engagement, there should be something there about the people who know the system, who understand health and understand the needs of the public and particularly of their patients, being in leading roles in a new health system should potentially be a strength. Integrated care should be a strength. Integrated care in the UK or in the English system, we're talking increasingly and being encouraged to look at integration between not only primary and secondary and tertiary care, but also between health care and social care. And the agenda is being encouraged in that direction. So again, potentially a strength, but the actual reforms themselves don't automatically make integration easier. But again, but the encouragement is there. So I'm trying to be sympathetic that there are potential, certainly hypothetical strengths to the reforms. And the potential for evidence-based decision-making, it was always there. Whether we deliver it this time around is to be achieved, to be seen. The risks associated with any extensive reform, inefficiencies, gaps because of the confusion that reform creates, loss of memory, and we're seeing a lot of all of these, morale of the workforce, people are very confused. Morale has been further hit in the UK by a report earlier this year, it was published in February, following a very difficult time in the Midlands, which may or may not have been reported in the US, where many patients were found to have died as a result of particularly poor care in one healthcare system in the Midlands. And the report came out effectively damning the culture of the health system and I'll come on to a quote from the recommendation there. But that alongside reform basically to say to us all, this isn't good enough, you need to do things very differently, it's very difficult for that not to affect morale of people working at the front line. And other unintended consequences, that's my let out clause, I don't know what they are, but clearly there will be unintended consequences. These particular reforms, everything I've just said, plus a big loss of not only organisational memory, but organisational competence, which is having to be regrown, redeveloped. We're seeing higher costs, not lower costs. We've had to see a lot of training, capacity building of people now running, leading the system, particularly clinicians who've not had a previous experience or history of running a health system, but of running individual practices. Completely different story. There are risks to the ethics, the ethical foundations of the system. There's been a lot of people looking out for conflicts of interest, particularly in a primary care environment. Primary care physicians now responsible for commissioning decisions, and some of the providers of the services which are being commissioned are those same primary care physicians. So we've immediately got some conflicts that need to be worked through, need to be brought transparently into play and understood, and the credibility of the profession maintained. As I said already, I think that the lack of public health intercommissioning is going to cause difficulties. The risk of widening inequalities, we have a history of populations that are more affluent receiving better quality services, and there's some concern, quite a lot of concern, that the reforms may well reinforce that gap. We're seeing instability in the system, as I said. And the other thing we're seeing, which may or may not be important, but for those of us who sort of grew up with the National Health Service in the UK, that's been completely eroded. And we definitely have now four different health systems in four different countries of the UK, including different public health systems as well, with risks to the public health as well as to one's perhaps ideology of having a UK NHS. So what might a health impact assessment have concluded had we had one? Are the NHS reforms relevant to health? Absolutely. That's an easy question to answer. Would the benefits of reform outweigh the harms? We don't know. What would be the impact on some key indicators? We don't know, but we'll keep looking. We do need to keep monitoring, evaluating the impact of the reforms. And we also need to jump in very quickly with mitigating actions should we discover that the harms are beginning to outweigh the benefits. So have we made progress since 1948? Many of us in the NHS. I've not been in the NHS since 1948, I'm delighted to tell you. But I've been in quite a long time. Okay. Our founding father of the NHS, widely recognised to be Aneurin Bevan, at the launch of the NHS, said this is the biggest single experiment in social services the world has ever seen undertaken. It will last as long as there are folk left to fight for it. So there are folk left to fight for it, and now we're entering a new phase of the experiment. In 1983, a gentleman from the Sainsbury's supermarket chain was brought in to review the service, and he found a complete lack of leadership. Derek Wanless, the late Derek Wanless, came in 2002 and produced, I think, one of the most valuable statements still, which we haven't really acted upon, whereby he made a statement that the NHS is only going to be affordable if people out there, ordinary members of the public, understand and engage with their own health. It isn't just about imposing on people the expectation that they'll make sensible choices. It's about building up individual capacity to understand health, and we still need to do that. And then, as a result of the scandal in the Midlands, as I said, the report published in February this year, France's report, what we need is a complete change again. Now, this was stated, don't forget, 1 month before the latest reforms were implemented. And he's saying that's not good enough. We need to start all over again. So real impact on morale. So have we made progress? It'll be interesting to see. Our outcomes have improved, obviously, significantly since 1948, as they have the world over. But whether these particular reforms will help, the jury is still out. So thank you very much for listening.
Justice system in accordance with the needs of the population. Dr. Coe, of course, is representing our system.
CMS has implemented some of that value-based purchasing effort over the last several years as part of the Obamacare rollout. So we're going to be hearing more and more of this as time goes on. At the end of the days of fee-for-service have peaked, and we've got to look for better models because we keep giving more and more services and not looking at outcomes is driving up bill and not necessarily making people healthy. And this is where
Okay, so I'm sure what she's going to do is going to mind you.